the limits set by the deal. Now Tehran and Washington will engage in indirect talks for the seventh round in Vienna on November 29th to seek ways for the U.S. to rejoin the deal and return for Iran to come back to full obligation.
Iran assured the IAEA that it will return to full compliance to the JCPOA, but it says that requires a political will from the U.S. and Europe to lift the anti-Iran sanctions, an issue which seems to be the gist of next week's discussions in Vienna. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Under the slogan the U.S. supports the military and economic escalation and the continuation of aggression and siege, thousands of Yemenis filled the streets of the capital Sana'a and other cities to demonstrate against the U.S. for its support for the ongoing Saudi war on their country.
The U.S.'s backing rule has been confirmed by the country's officials' statements. We are involved in a comprehensive battle to defend our homeland. The recent escalation is the result of the repeated defeats that the Saudi-led coalition has been suffering, especially in Marib province.
Protesters chanted slogans blaming the U.S. for the humanitarian crisis in the country, saying that the U.S. will remain the main supporter of the Saudi-led war on Yemen, no matter who takes power in Washington.
The U.S. is providing Saudi Arabia with logistic and political support. The blockade on Yemen has been imposed based on the U.S. order. The U.S. is the enemy of all Yemenis. We vow to continue our war against the enemy till our land is completely liberated.
Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen on March 2015 and maintained an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, including children, and led the country to the brink of famine.
People here hold the U.S. responsible for the deteriorating situation in their country, which according to the U.N. is suffering the world's worst humanitarian crisis. They say the U.S. policies have emboldened Saudi Arabia to increase its pressure on the impoverished nation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Dockers from the Autonomous Port Workers Collective Union, or CALP, say ships carrying cargoes of tanks, helicopters and other weapons are continued to be sent to Saudi Arabia from Italian ports in breach of local laws and the country's constitution. In January this year, Rome introduced a ban on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates due to their involvement in the war on Yemen, where tens of thousands of civilians have been killed so far. In June, however, some of the restrictions were eased after Abu Dhabi threatened to evict Italian aircraft and personnel from a key military base in retaliation for the arms embargo. Dockers say U.S.-built tanks bound for Riyadh have recently transited through the port of Genoa.
The latest shipment of weapons arrived at the Genoa port about 2 weeks ago. There were 12 third-generation M1 Abrams tanks, as many transport and combat helicopters, and several containers full of missiles, warheads destined for Saudi Arabia. Every 20-25 days, a new shipment of weapons docks at the Genoa port.
According to the CALP Dockers Union, the ban on arms sales produced in Italy on Riyadh and Abu Dhabi is circumvented by disassembling the weapons and sending the pieces separately. Dockers Unions and the Weapon Watch, which is an independent observatory on arms transfers through Italian ports, say each time new shipments of weapons reaches Genoa, they inform the port authorities, but no action is taken. CALP Dockers have said a new anti-militaristic internationalist movement is growing, with port workers from several cities across the world ready to join forces. Unions are working on organizing an international strike against arms exports towards countries involved in the war in mid-December.
A new shipment of weapons is scheduled for loading on a Saudi cargo at the port of Genoa this weekend. Dockers will be staging a protest with hundreds of people marching to the port to support them. Max Civili, Rome.
It's a day as usual for millions of residents across the bustling Indian capital, New Delhi. As winter looms, debates and awareness about pollution starts making news. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. With the arrival of the festival of Diwali and the farmers clearing fields for the next crop, it's the capital which has to pay heavy price. Over the last 2 weeks, New Delhi has been choking with a lethal layer of thick smog hovering over the residents who are now gasping for fresh air. For this labor working in the outskirts of Delhi, it's a day as usual. Since last week, the hospitals are witnessing rising numbers of admissions, as many are struggling with breathing issues. Health officials have advised people to stay indoors and avoid outdoor physical activities. New Delhi has taken some measures, such as work from home for government employees and ban on trucks entering the city till November 26. But many say there is a need for a long-term solution.
I think the government must take this issue serious, as it's the matter of health of the citizens. If we can't take steps now, our future generation will pay a heavy cost.
Considering the alarming situation, schools have also been shut till further notice. The country's top court directed the administration to take this issue on utmost priority and find a long-term solution. The air quality in New Delhi deteriorated after Diwali on November 4, shrouding the entire capital with toxic smog. Stubble burning by farmers in the neighboring state of Haryana and Uttar Pradesh, which surrounds the capital, is also blamed for the crisis. The story is the same every year. This morning, the air quality has improved due to change in wind speed. The administration has also taken a string of measures to tackle the crisis. Experts, however, say more strategies are needed to solve the pollution crisis in the Indian capital. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite, words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instrument.
The spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. More signs of a country divided. That's the reaction of many Americans after Kyle Rittenhouse was found not guilty on all counts. He had taken an automatic weapon to a protest, shooting and killing two people and wounding another. Many people were shocked by the verdict and say it's about white privilege, and others say justice was served. Stay with us as we look at this ever-increasing divide in the United States. I'm going to start off by crossing over to Washington, D.C., talking to Colin Campbell. Colin, good to see you. Colin, I mean, it's just so familiar. I just don't even realize how many times we've had this discussion over the years of something like this. Tell me what's being said on that side of things.
Well, a lot of people like myself, Marzia, were not surprised at this verdict. I mean, here you have a young white guy. Many people said he characterized him as a boy. He was 17 at the time of the incident, but now he's officially a man at age 18. But yet still, they, in some of the narratives that were coming from the U.S. here, they still characterized him as a boy. Of course, diminishing his accountability in the incident, where he took the lives of two people and then maimed another person. And so when you look at the optics of a man who, or a boy at the time, had a gun that is intended to kill people and goes into a protest where things are very volatile and unpredictable, one can almost expect that the outcomes may not be typically favorable with that. And then when you see someone walking away to live the rest of their life as a free man, despite having taken the lives of two people, There are a lot of people who think that a grave injustice was done here. Now, like you alluded to before, on the other side, there are those who said, well, he legally had the gun, he was allowed to be on public streets during that protest, and he was defending himself. So the jury ruled or decided in the correct direction. And that's where you see there are two schools of thought, two ideals, two understandings of the principles of America, where you can have a gun and you could exacerbate a situation. But if that situation turns on you, even though you might have been the one to instigate it, you legally have the right to defend yourself and obviously take a life without any type of reprisal. And I think that's what people are having problems dealing with as they try to process this verdict, that it was legally okay, but ethically, it was really an inhumane act that was committed by a boy who is now considered a man in American society.
I mean, what you just said, legally okay, and one would wonder if it was a black teen that had done that, if it would have been legally okay. Thanks so much for that update out of D.C., Colin Campbell. I'd like to welcome our guests to the spotlight, writer and journalist Abayomi Azikiwe out of Detroit. And writer and rights activist Yane Nadako out of Philadelphia.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
We'll cross over to Philadelphia and start this off with Yane. Thanks so much again for being with us. Your overall opinion of the verdict?
Well, I think that, you know, it's nuanced, as was discussed by the previous correspondent, in that what we observed is that there was a lot of consideration for the humanity, overwhelm, bad mistakes, youth of, you know, Rittenhouse. And that's something that's consistently happens, where there's a willingness to care about whomever the perpetrator may be when that perpetrator is white, and that same kind of consideration and care is generally not extended to people who are not white. And so I think that when you look at a system where you have individuals who have actually had acts of self-defense over the course of decades of people actually really truly attacking and oppressing them directly or through as members of a larger community, and those people are in prison sometimes for decades. We've got a large number of political prisoners and in the U.S. right now who are in prison for having defended themselves and protected their lives against aggressive violence in a context that we know has always been very violent. And there's very little to no consideration given to the circumstances of what happened when people are fighting for their cases. You know, when you see repeatedly that there are these efforts that these vigilantes take on the flip side and actually establish the aggression, and then, you know, when that comes back on them, protect themselves from the aggression that they created in their in their engagement of the, the conflict, they're given all of this consideration. And so it just really speaks to what, speaking of political prisoners, political prisoner from Philadelphia, Mumia Abu-Jamal, said about the law here in the United States, which is that it means whatever the white men of that time want it to mean. It's not universally applied. It's not, it
okay.
It's created as if it's objective, but it's not universally applied.
All right, stay with me, Yanhe. Let me get Abayomi in on this discussion. Abayomi, your take in general, I mean, if he was a black teenager walking in the street with an automatic weapon, then use his weapon to kill and wound, to kill two people, wound another, do you think that the court would have looked at the case in the same way? I think that's the question of the day for especially people living outside the United States who perhaps can't understand this whole situation as well. Abayomi, I can't hear you. Okay, I think you're muted. I think your mic is muted. Okay, I'm going to come back to you. Hopefully we can clear this up, the technical side of things. We can get this done. I'll go back to Yanhe. Yanhe, the same question. I mean, because especially when you're talking to the international audience, a lot of times people cannot really understand racism in the United States in the way that it is. And
right.
When they see a case like this, and they're like, well, of course, perhaps then, okay, Abayomi, I think I have your voice. Can you hear me?
All right. Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
So stay with me, Yanhe. I'm going to go back to Abayomi. Thanks so
yes,
much.
Sir.
I'm glad we got that technical issue cleared. Did you hear the question, or should I repeat it, Abayomi?
Yeah, I was saying that Tamir Rice in Cleveland several years ago was 12 years old. And he was playing with a toy gun in a public park. And a white man called 911 and said it was a child playing with a gun. It's probably harmless. Well, if it was harmless, why are you calling the police? So the dispatcher called the police and said it was a black man in the park with a gun, calling a gun. And two white police officers showed up and gunned him down within a matter of seconds. The question is almost rhetorical. This would not be the same discussion if you had a young African-American who was charged with killing two whites. And it's interesting that Rittenhouse killed two other white people and wounded a third person. One of them was Jewish. So it just goes to show even whites who are demonstrating against racism in the United States are subject to brutality, to vigilante violence, and that's just the reality that we're dealing with.
Yes, and Yanhe, I mean, we witnessed some very interesting acts during this case. I mean, such as the judge allowing him, Rittenhouse, to choose his own jury by lot. The judge said that people feel better when they are in control. It, in so many ways, it's so mind-boggling because we have seen time and time again the dehumanization process. For example, when people of color are arrested or are held on trial, put on trial, and then we see this basically the judge talking about needing control, that person. I mean, it's so mind-boggling. Your take on and so many of the situation that took place during this case.
Well, you know, there's a message that I hear. You know, we talk about the messaging that goes out through the actions and activities. You know, we talk about dog whistles, signals that you give. When you look at this case, you look at the case of Ahmaud Arbery, who was gunned down by two vigilante, individuals while taking a jog. There's a message that's going out. Even when you look at how Dylan Roof, the young man who went to the church and shot up, a church of people who welcomed him into the church, and how they treated him after, you know, during the arrest process and route to the prison, stopping and getting them little something to eat.
Right.
There's a message that's being delivered about what you're doing and whether or not what you're doing is actually aligned with the goals of the larger establishment. And whether, therefore, it will be actually really treated punitively when they do these things. So there's a message that these people are actually aligned and deserve protection because what they did is actually fits the goals and making sure that there's a certain community that stay in their place as it relates to this hierarchical oppressive system. So that's what I hear in that situation. And one thing I just want to mention is that we've not only had the example of Tamir Rice, who was shot down with a toy gun within seconds of being encountered by the police. We also have examples of quite a number of fully grown, clearly grown white men who have been in public places where there were crowds of people with actual definitive guns waving them and being talked down by the police instead of being shot down.
Right. Abayomi, what does this do to the psyche of African Americans in general, living this day in and day out? And of course, we understand different parts of the country perhaps is somewhat different. But in general, this type of systemic racism is part of the soul of the United States. What does it do to the psyche of people living with this day in and day out? I think that part of it is really not talked about enough.
I think that as W.E.B. Du Bois talked about the double consciousness, and you have to, as a black person in North America, you have to be aware all the time, particularly when you're confronting the authorities, that you could be severely harmed or killed. And you know, the whole book that was written in the 1960s about black rage, from a psychiatric standpoint, is a reality. So yes, you do have to be extremely aware and extremely conscious about your racial identity and skin color in the United States, and also whites as well. This case illustrates clearly that if they come out in solidarity with African Americans, they could easily be killed or stigmatized for life.
It's interesting you talked about the solidarity. I want to look at the solidarity, Yane, on the other side of Rittenhouse, because the funding for his legal case, there was so much money raised for it. I mean, it sounds similar to back in St. Louis, and we saw Mike Brown being killed, and we saw the cop who did that and raised so much money for his defense. Let's talk about that divide and that side of things. That what is it then that will bring this type of solidarity for someone who obviously has killed people, but others feel that it's their responsibility to give them all the support that they can, even financial support?
Well, it's solidarity with the ideas of what is called white supremacy. I don't like that term because there's nothing supreme about these behaviors and actions, but that is what it is that people are taking a position on the side of, and they know that that's what they're doing. They're taking a position that what he did was heroic or necessary, and that he needs to be protected. And it's really his whiteness that I believe is drawing people to provide that kind of support and their desire to continue to perpetuate these systems that give them a feeling of having a leg up, or the opportunity to get a leg up, and what for most people it would be their whiteness would provide for them. So I perceive that as being people are right now, we're in a country that is really asking people to choose between the side of humanity and the side of white supremacy. And so some people are making that choice, and they're making the choice on the side of white supremacy consciously or unconsciously, because there are parts of the society that don't actually engage with a large number of the diverse parts of the population to actually know and understand what it's like, especially in some of these urban environments and some of these under-resourced environments. They don't even understand what the environment is like, and that ignorance enables them to continue to be aligned outside of their and against their class interest with this white supremacist system that continues to oppress many of those people as well.
Right. Well, Abiyomi, how do you explain what appears to be this deep disdain for black people in certain official circles in the United States and obviously certain individuals? Still, even in 2021, there is a type of hatred that, again, perhaps people who haven't seen it cannot understand, that an individual that you don't even know, that you could have such deep resentment towards it. Explain this to my international audience, please.
It goes back to the period of enslavement. It was necessary for the white ruling class in the United States to demonize, to make it appear as if African people were inherently inferior. They needed to be controlled. They had to be exploited, and they had to be converted to the European belief systems. So this is the origin of it. In order to maintain that system, they had to institutionalize these theories. And then even after the Civil War and the purported liberation of African people from enslavement, in order to maintain the same system of racial hierarchy and national oppression and economic exploitation, they had to continue this myth that African people were genetically inferior to whites. And even today, in academic circles in the United States, you still have these theories that are being advanced. And it becomes even more important today because you have a rising minority that is becoming a majority. It will be a majority within perhaps 20 to 25 years, a collective majority, being black, brown, Middle Eastern, Asian, and indigenous people will be a majority collectively in the United States. So they have to reinstitute another form of Jim Crow and apartheid. That's what the whole debate is around critical race theory in the schools. Critical race theory came out of the law schools in the United States many decades ago. Yet they use it as a buzzword, as a wedge issue to justify not teaching the history of enslavement, the history of the forced removal and genocide of indigenous people, the history of the Civil War, that it was based upon whether or not the United States would be a slave system or a capitalist system, the suppression of African political rights, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Civil Rights Movement, the Black Power Movement, all of that. They want to suppress the teaching of this so they can rationalize or attempt to rationalize the continuation of this white supremacist system.
Well, Yonet, we've seen protests after the verdict taking place in several cities. Can a system which has been built and has profited from racism actually change itself? And I guess the question would be, why would it change itself? I mean, these demonstrators, protesters are demanding a change in the justice system, but your take on that?
Yeah, I think that this system is not going to change itself, and I don't think that people are going to change the system unless they change it over it with a new system that's replacing it. And a lot of people are beginning to understand the imperative to actually just build something that works for everyone and not only for a small select few. And I think part of the challenge is to help people who actually do have the same material interests to be able to operate with that understanding and not be manipulated by the ways that those who are in conflict with those material interests are pitting groups against each other while continuing to keep pressure from above from below.
So what is key? Staying with you, Yannis. So what is key
that
here?
Is going to be able to be transformed, and I think that I personally believe that it is not a good use of time to put a lot of energy into that. Certainly, I think that there are things that people need to do in order to obtain relief from the violent ways that the system itself in our communities. But what we really need is for people thinking about what new things we can have and building something together collectively that takes care of all of the needs of the whole community.
Okay, well, Abiyomi, there have been growing calls in the United States in general about secession and having the country break up in several autonomous regions. Would something like this help the racism issue in the United States, or What do you see as key? What has to happen to change this status quo?
Yeah, the overall system has to be thrown out, and there has to be a new system instituted. And in terms of partition, you know, the issue involving the Civil War between 1861 and 1865 killed over 1 million people and dislocated many more. So it's a serious question. And we can see the seeds of a coming Civil War, another Civil War in the United States in the 21st century. How can these issues be resolved short of some type of violent explosion or conflict when you have a situation where whites can at will not only kill blacks, they kill whites who express solidarity with blacks. So it's a very serious situation.
Unfortunately, I'm out of time, but I appreciate talking to both of you, writer and journalist Abu Yomi as a Kiwi out of Detroit, and writer and rights activist Yane Nadago out of Philadelphia. And as always, we appreciate you being with us, and hopefully you have enjoyed this spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the all-compassionate, the all-merciful, salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the noble Quran that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. As you know, last week we started explanation of Surah Zariyat, which opens with the divine oath on the scattering winds that blow far and wide with their rain-bearing clouds, followed by other signs of God's mercy that are evident in the orderly world of nature, including the vast universe with its fascinating appearance, such as the stars that adorn the sky and are actually faraway planets, which are beyond the perception of mankind, however scientifically advanced. These are all clear and vivid signs of the infinite power of the Almighty Creator, who, on the Day of Judgment, will resurrect all mankind into their original shape and form, even if they have turned after death into powdered bones and scattered everywhere. We continue from where we left you last week, and here are ayahs 10, 11, 12, 13, and 14 of this surah that refer to the fate of the deniers of the hereafter who refuse to acknowledge sound arguments or submit to reason, and have deviated from belief in God, the message of the prophets, the teachings of the infallible imams, and the reality of the day of resurrection.
قتل الخراصون الذين هم في غمرة ساهون يسألون أيان يوم الدين يوم هم على النار يفتنون ذوقوا فتنتكم هذا الذي كنتم به تستعجلون.
Perish the liars who are heedless in a stupor. They ask, when will be the day of retribution? It is the day when they will be tormented in the fire. And the angels will tell them, taste your torment. This is what you used to hasten. Ayah 10 is actually a curse on those who are liars and whose non-existence is better than their existence, since they are immersed in the satanic trait of gossiping based on their surmises and conjectures that create doubts in the minds of others. The next two ayahs mean to say that such persons who are heedless of the truth are actually in the state of neglect and ignorance. That is the reason they mockingly ask the believers of the day of recompense. In reply, God tells them in Ayah 13 that the day of recompense is the day on which the disbelievers shall be burned in the eternal fire, and the angels responsible for punishing them will say, taste the torment that you used to mock in worldly life. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, the liars are the most despicable persons, since they spread sedition in society and create doubts in the minds of others. Number two, the disbelievers have actually distanced themselves from God's mercy because of their denial of the truth. And number three, those who mock at the divine promise of the day of resurrection and recompense are deceiving their own selves and will taste the torment of the eternal fire of hell. Listen to ayahs 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 of the same surah.
Inna al-muttaqeen fi jannatin wa 'uyun akhidin ma ataahum rabbuhum innahum kanu qabla dhalika muhsinin kanu qalilan min al-layli ma yahja'un وبالأسحار هم يستغفرون وفي أموالهم حق للسائل والمحروم.
Indeed, the God-weary will be amid gardens and springs, receiving what their Lord has given them, for they had been virtuous aforetime. They used to sleep little during the night, and at dawn they would plead for forgiveness, and there was a share in their wealth for the beggar and the deprived. The Noble Quran, after a depiction in the previous ayahs of those who disbelieve, die in the state of sin without repentance, and thus make themselves deserving of divine punishment in the fire of hell, depicts in these ayahs the blissful state of the virtuous believers and the bounties and blessings reserved for them in paradise. The believers who were always conscious of God Almighty and during worldly life abstain from forbidden pleasures will be rewarded with gardens, springs, and many other means of comfort that are beyond our imagination. The God-weary or the muttaqin are those who never take pride in their piety, worship, and awe of God Almighty, and never lose hope in divine mercy. The qualities of the muttaqin, as described in these ayahs, reached perfection to the maximum degree in the exemplary life of the Prophet and his immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Therefore, all believers are commanded to follow in their footsteps, taking them as guides, and disregarding all others who have defective character and conduct. As ayahs 17 and 18 mean to say, the God-weary keep awake most of the night, sleeping a little and spending their time in the worship and remembrance of the all-merciful Lord, while in the morning, at the break of dawn, they plead the Almighty Creator for forgiveness for their own shortcomings as well as the faults of their parents, relatives, friends, and acquaintances. The next ayah enumerates another noble attribute of the God-weary, pointing out that they share their wealth with the beggars, the destitute, and the deprived. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, abstinence from forbidden pleasures brings eternal bliss in the hereafter. Number two, the rewards of paradise are beyond our imagination. Number three, the God-weary are always conscious of the Almighty Creator, worship Him with sincerity, are never boastful of their good deeds, and follow the enlightened path of the Prophet and his blessed progeny, the Ahlul Bayt. Number four, another characteristic of the true believers is spending long hours of the night in supplications and remembrance of the all-merciful Lord, while invoking Him for forgiveness for themselves and for others at dawn. And number five, what is given to the needy and the deprived are their own rights, since God has decreed a share for them in the wealth of the rich, who should not consider charity as a favor. Now we invite you to listen to ayahs 20, 21, 22, and 23 of Surah Zariyat in conclusion of this week's episode of The Path Towards Enlightenment.
وفي الأرض آيات للموقنين وفي أنفسكم أفلا تبصرون وفي السماء رزقكم وما توعدون فورب السماء والأرض إنه لحق مثل ما أنكم تنطقون.
And in the earth are signs for those who have conviction, and in your souls as well, will you not then perceive? And in the sky, is your provision and what you are promised. By the Lord of the sky and the earth, it is indeed the truth, just as it is a fact that you speak. These ayahs refer to the wonders of creation in the earth on which we live, in the sky by means of which our provision is guaranteed, and in our own selves as human beings, the best of God's creation blessed with the gifts of the intellect and speech. Many a secret lie in the earth, its distance from the sun, which make conditions ideal for life, its surface and its depth, such as mountains, valleys, and a variety of minerals, water sources, various kinds of birds, beasts, and insects, and last but not the least, vegetation that includes different fruits and vegetables, in addition to colorful flowers and their fragrance. These are indeed clear signs of divine omnipotence and wisdom for those who use their brains to acquire conviction. Ayah 21 is meant to jolt human conscience to perceive the omnipotence of the one and only Creator, with its emphasis on, in your souls, will you then not perceive? It means the different states of the body from conception to old age, including the physical senses, the nervous, respiratory, and digestive systems, as well as the sight, the hearing, and the defense mechanism, all of which serve as manifestations of divine wisdom that is reflected in the various instincts of the human beings and their needs. Thus, by contemplating on our own physical and spiritual aspects, including the gender differences and their attachment to each other, as well as the mental faculties, our mind understands the mysteries of the natural forces and discovers new methods for advancement in knowledge and its application. These wonders should make us become better cognizant of God Almighty, the day of resurrection for the final judgment, and the rewards and punishment it entails. A famous statement from the Prophet of Islam says, "One who knows his own self indeed recognizes his Lord." Ayah 22 means to say that our provision and what has been promised descends upon the earth from the sky through rain, snow, and sunlight, all of which make vegetation grow in order to feed us. This is another sign of divine mercy. Ayah 23 is a divine oath on the sky and earth that whatever the Noble Quran says is indeed the undeniable truth, as clear as your power of speech. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, the Quran draws our attention to the wonders that the earth contains in order to help us recognize the one and only Creator. Since the more we discover this phenomena, the better our realization of the resurrection day. Number two, proper reflection on our own self enables us to have better cognition of God. Number three, the sky showers the earth with rain and sunlight, which along with the wind helps the growth of vegetation to provide food for mankind and all creatures. And number four, the power of speech along with the intellect is among the divine blessings.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.